May it please the court. The city of St. Louis, in this case, we have the advantage of having an ordinance that was adopted in 2005, which gives us a fairly lengthy track record as to how the ordinance was administered in the city of St. Louis. The chief of police who's here today testified in the case and none of the testimony is contested, that the program has been a resounding success in preventing red light violations. In fact, I don't want to bore you with numbers, but the incidence of red light violations where cameras have been installed has been reduced by 64% since the cameras were installed. In addition, 84% of the people who actually pay their ticket never get another one. So from the public safety standpoint, the red light camera program is an undeniable success. The record in trial was unrebutted on that point.
Is there any statistics on how many accidents are prevented?
Yes, also, we did have evidence on that there's been a reduction in time in collisions at intersections with red light cameras. There were three separate studies referenced by the police chief on those points, by the Kansas City Police Department, the Missouri Department of Highways and Transportation, and the Missouri Department of Transportation. So there was evidence that was also unrebutted on that point as well. The respondents presented no evidence whatsoever on the public safety element. So all the testimony was unrebutted on that point. So in that light, what we have is a very efficient use of technology that allows our chief of police to devote manpower and focus his manpower on crimes and preventing crimes and not have to occupy manpower with traffic violations. It's been a very productive use, a very successful use since 2005 when this ordinance was enacted. Getting to the gist of their argument is the one that was touched on earlier, is whether this should be a criminal or civil, an ordinance violation should be criminal or civil. And I know you went over it, but I'll briefly go over it myself.
And in the course of doing that, can you address what quasi-criminal is and how that differs from the other two?
My understanding is that it's a quasi-criminal is a civil proceeding, but it has terms and elements like prosecution, guilty plea, things like that are normally associated with a criminal matter.
Does it have any of the protections that are normally provided in a criminal matter?
I think they're relaxed. One recent case that said that is Mills in Western District of Missouri, that protections under the Fifth, Sixth, and Eighth Amendment are relaxed in ordinance violations. And that's consistent with this court's rules. This court has separate rules for ordinance violations, and those rules say that they should be interpreted to have an efficient, speedy, rapid turnover in municipal ordinance violation cases. One way to do that is to relax some of these standards.
They don't pay the fine, do they go to jail?
No. The record was unrebutted, stipulated actually, that since 2005, no one has ever gone to jail.
But that's a different question. Could, and I know you said in St. Louis they have not, but would the ordinance permit that? The city has chosen not to do it. But
it's conceivable, and that's why I think the track record is so important. There is a general penalty ordinance.
But there could be a change in administration, and then it would be. Would that affect how we analyze the case? I mean, in other words, if we're looking at the ordinance, that's different than looking at behavior under the ordinance. And
that's true. It's not really the administration. I guess if you count the municipal judges as administration, but the municipal judges are the ones who set the maximum penalty by court order. And they are overseen by the circuit court judges. So it's actually the courts.
Is the ordinance written okay on its face if it would permit that? I mean, I take it it's your position that's still okay. It's not that it's unconstitutional, but it's being applied constitutionally. Or it's in violation of state law, but it's being applied consistent with state law. Or is that your argument?
Well, that is one argument, but I think also the city's traffic ordinance has a general penalty provision, which includes the possibility of some minimal jail time. That applies to all.
And is that for failure to appear, or is that for actual violation of?
It's not for failure to appear. You're okay. Not jailed for failure to appear. It's for all traffic violations.
Okay.
So the
So the city of St. Louis has a ordinance that says there will not be jail time?
No, the ordinance says, the general traffic ordinance, which this defaults to because the red light camera ordinance has no penalty provision. There is a second ordinance that has a general penalty provision, which is applicable to all city traffic violations, including red light cameras. That's in the record at the legal file at page 403 it starts. But so the jail time is possible for any municipal ordinance violation that's covered in the traffic code, and that includes red light cameras. I guess my answer to the question is a little long-winded, is the fact that jail time is possible, I don't think takes it out of the criminal versus civil. I don't think that's determinative on that issue. Because unless, like you suggested earlier, all municipal ordinance violations are going to be converted to criminal matters.
In an individual case, if someone was given jail time, would additional procedural protections be required before that could occur?
I don't think it's set up that way. No, that hasn't happened, so it's hard. Okay. I haven't really.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Okay.
The city of St. Peter's camera gets the driver's face.
Yes.
The speeding camera case, it was not clear to me, but I think that's only tags. What's the record on the technology in the city of St. Louis systems?
They only take the tags. There is no facial shot. And are you asking why, or are you just asking?
Well, and so the presumption in this, that's in this ordinance, is that the owner is the operator, and it's rebuttable. How?
Correct.
How?
Any way you want to rebut it. There is a provision for an affidavit which gives you two options, and these options allow you to avoid a court appearance. You can either write down whatever reason you want to say, I should not be held liable for this. There's no restriction, or you can identify another person who was driving. Those are the two options.
And what about the situation where Judge Draper suggests to his wife not to go through a red light?
I don't suggest that. Tell her.
I don't know how far that goes.
Well, for everyone but Judge Draper, we would still give him the violation. Because it's really the violation we're penalizing, not anything to do with permission or anything like that. So there is a presumption that the owner was driving. And there was unrebutted evidence on that in trial here also, that 70 to 80% of the times in a routine traffic stop, the owner is the driver. So there is a rational relation between.
What percentage?
But 70 to 80%. It depended on how the questions were asked. Respondents had a police officer witness who said 70%.
So your ordinance is a failure, it's an operational failure, not a failure to supervise, an owner's failure to supervise.
Correct. If you run a red light, we assume the owner was a driver, and that's a rebuttable presumption.
Is there a difference between a prima facie case and a rebuttable presumption?
I don't think there's a substantive difference.
I'm just wondering where a presumption arises, as opposed to you presented some evidence that 80% are owners, and that may or may not be adequate to indicate this particular person is a driver. But assuming for the moment it were, why isn't that just a prima facie case as opposed to a presumption, which carries lots of other collateral consequences of creating a presumption?
Well, the presumption is actually for the benefit of the driver, the owner, so they can come in and say, I was not the driver, and not have to pay the penalty.
Why isn't it just you presented some evidence they were the driver, they can present some evidence they weren't? Why does it create, every time you make your case a admissible case, that doesn't create a presumption?
Well, with the presumption, that's the burden of evidence. We still have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt.
Are you saying you make a submissible case by proving they were the owner, or are you saying it creates a evidentiary presumption which carries different baggage with it and different consequences than simply saying you make your case?
Well, you don't make a case just by proving owner. You also have to prove the violation.
Yes.
I don't think that's what you're asking, but.
So if I got a ticket and I said, well, I have proof I was in Kansas City at the time, then that I win the case, right?
You'd be out. Actually, I know from personal experience, we received an affidavit from a lady who sent her airplane ticket in and a credit card receipt for lunch in Minneapolis around the time the ticket was given, and it was dismissed by the city council.
Isn't that anecdotal?
Pardon me?
I mean, in that one instance that happened, but what kind of guarantees do people have?
There are no guarantees. It's you send the affidavit in, and the city council evaluates it and may dismiss it under the ordinance.
Well, but let's follow along. Say they bring that charge against the lady. She asks for a jury trial. If the state's evidence, if the city's evidence, is that she was the owner of the vehicle and the vehicle ran the red line, and rests, the case goes to the jury, even though she stood up and said, I was in Minneapolis, and here's a picture of me standing next to a Minneapolis cop at the exact same time.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part.
Well, I mean, no matter how good her evidence is, it goes to the jury because you've made a submissible case by proving she was the owner and the car ran the red light.
Right, the jury have to decide if she rebutted the presumption, correct, if it goes to trial. As a practical matter, these jury trials do not happen here as a judge who makes that determination.
Does she have to present any evidence? I mean, the jury could find they don't, just because 80% of owners are drivers, if that's all you submitted, there was a violation and she's the owner, the finder of fact could find against you. Are you saying as a matter of law they have to find?
There is no. Nothing requires any particular finding of fact. It establishes the presumption, then it's up to the fact finder after that point.
The statistical evidence was not offered as proof in any given case. It was offered in a DJ action to try to prove that there was a rational basis for the presumption.
Correct. Yeah, if I gave a misimpression on that, I'm sorry. Their claim was this was not rationally related. There was no rational relation between the presumption and the fact that it was presumed, and that evidence was for that purpose.
Can you really quickly, and your time is up, but address the appropriateness of the DJ case versus contesting this in the municipal action?
We believe that the municipal courts have specific jurisdiction to hear municipal ordinance violations, and that either of these respondents wanted to raise those claims in their municipal court proceeding, they should have. And that was actually the holding when the same ordinance was litigated in Smith versus St. Louis. They said a party who did not go to municipal court could not succeed on any equitable claims if they didn't attempt their municipal court.
And they say you can this issue can avoid review through that because you keep dismissing it, as occurred here when they won at the trial court level and their other violation.
Well, this wasn't a municipal court proceeding. No, this was
right.
We haven't done that in a municipal court proceeding.
Well, you did on the appeal. You dismissed your appeal where they won.
This is extra record, but we dismissed the appeal because the same party had another appeal coming, and this had a trial record that was much more developed. It was just a better case to appeal. There was no point in my mind in having two appeals at the same time.
Thank you. No further questions. Thank you, counsel. You'll have some time on rebuttal. I don't think we had any questions posed toward him. Thank you for offering it.
Welcome back, Mr. Schock.
A pleasure to be here, I'm sure. The court seems interested in the rebuttable presumption in this case. I think I'll just start there. The Cook case talks about presumptions. It's a parking case. There are two parking cases, that one and the Hertz case. So in Cook, there's one critical word about a presumption, and it says it has to be reasonable. It has to be reasonable. So what does reasonable mean? And whether the presumption is a lawful presumption to make, in my view, depends on the kind of case it is. I talked in the briefing that parking is different than running red lights. It's much more serious. It's a public safety issue. Parking is a convenience of the public issue. We assert, if you take this 70 to 80% number, 70 is at the low end, 80 at the high, we conceded that for the purposes of this case. It's never been really fully analyzed all these studies, but just I can tell you the coffee store check, everybody raised their hand who drove here in a car that they own in their own name. I think 70% is about right.
Of course, when you said about parking, if you park in front of a fire hydrant, that's a public safety issue.
Absolutely, and we didn't really dig into that one. I think the fines are much more heavy. It's much more serious. I think they tow you right away. I mean, that's kind of a different area of the parking.
Thank you for your patience.
But anyway, when we talk about the word reasonable in this Cook case, my argument is simple. 70 to 80% is not enough to make the presumption because it's not reasonable. We would capture too many people with the receipt of a notice of violation, and that's simply not lawful under the due process requirements. So that's my argument.
Basically, they've done nothing. They get this notice that their car ran a red light, and it puts the burden on them to do an affidavit to get an attorney.
That's right where I'm going next, if I may.
Please.
So then we look at, back to my earlier argument, it shouldn't be driven by what label we put on it. What we have to look at is what are the rights of the parties. And in a municipal proceeding of an ordinance violation, red light, speeding, these kinds of things, certainly as we, I've tried these cases in municipal court. You show up at 7 o'clock, judge calls it to order, the police officer testifies, and the client has the right to remain silent. The prosecutor has 100% of the burden of proof. That's certainly the practice we have. It's how we do it in this state. It is unfathomable to me that the judge in a municipal court proceeding would look down to the defendant and say, "Now, what do you have to say?" I mean, it's unfathomable, right? We would never do that. And the reason we wouldn't do that is because the conduct at issue is a serious safety violation. The person is charged, I'll call it an offense rather than a crime, so we don't have to go through the whole crime versus non-crime again. But these protections of the Constitution, the right to remain silent, the prosecutor to have the whole burden, are completely rejected in this scheme from the city of St. Louis. They hand you an affidavit and say, "Prove you didn't do it." That's crazy. It can't be right.
So what's the rationale that you could do it in a parking case, which is for convenience, and not in a safety issue? So are you arguing then that if we accept your rationale, all the prior parking decisions should be invalid?
No, Your Honor. But if one looks at that decision in Hertz, right in that last critical paragraph, I think the exact quote is, "In the field of automobile parking, we think this looks all right." So this court was making a distinction, and I talked about this earlier. Parking really is different than speeding, which
and can you tell us further why? Why would that be a rational place to draw a line?
Absolutely, and it goes to the public safety issue. Setting aside Judge Teitelman's issue about parking in front of the fire hydrant, if somebody in St. Louis parks downtown and leaves that car for 4 hours instead of the 2 hours you get for your quarters, then that's an inconvenience to the public. It has not put a public safety risk.
Didn't Cook say there was some public safety element to the parking? I think it talked about public safety.
Your Honor, I cannot remember. I'm sure if you think it's there.
But the degree of public safety. What about the, I think there's a disagreement in the briefs about whether a $100 or $150 fine is sufficiently substantial to be different in kind from a parking violation.
And that goes to the issue of stigma, which is talked about in all these cases, and the rights. There's sort of this ratcheting up. The more serious the offense, the more due process a person is entitled to. I mean, we see that.
And what if this court were to find that points had to be assessed? Would that also, and they're clearly not for parking, would that be?
Oh, I think that's part of it, absolutely. I mean, the points are, can be devastating to a person's driver's license, their insurance rates. I mean, for a lot of people in this country, if their insurance goes from $300 a month to $400, that busts the budget. That's the line from Charles Dickens. If one penny less than your income and you're okay, one penny more on the expenditures and it's unhappiness. But
there's due process elements, I'm sorry, you were saying?
Well, just this idea that I have of this word ratcheting up. I mean, when this court hears a death penalty case, I mean, everybody's on point. This is obviously the most serious thing. We're getting ready to take this. This is obviously an extreme example, but it's a real example. Everybody looks at every aspect of the due process that defendant is given. And so it's a more serious matter. There's more attention to the due process. One end, we have parking, where we seem to have approved this rebuttable presumption. What I'm suggesting is that speeding, red lights, are on the other side of the line.
There are evidentiary rebuttable presumptions employed throughout the criminal law in criminal cases, and nobody would argue that they're anything less than as serious as it gets. Your argument would, if they're not allowed when you run a red light, then they can't be allowed in anything more serious under your argument.
And I don't mean to say that, because as I said at the beginning of this portion of my argument, the Cook case focuses on the word reasonable.
Well, that's not actually so. It says it has to not be purely arbitrary or wholly unreasonable, unnatural, or extraordinary. That's different than saying it has to be reasonable.
And I agree with you. That's true. I short-circuited the language.
Well, and how? I'm not sure this is. While it might not be reasonable, is it wholly unreasonable?
So, let's go to the numbers. In this case, the evidence is 70% to 80%. If a police officer on routine patrol learned that there was a theft of a cigar in a convenience shop, and he thought there was a 70% chance, he might talk to the guy. That might be enough. Hey, I want to talk to you for a minute about it. Can you arrest him on a 70% chance? Would the prosecutor issue a charge where there was a 70% chance of it being right? I think it's I can't imagine it happening, because it would be wholly unreasonable to have a system in which people were charged with crimes and demanded that they defend them when there's only a 70% chance they did it.
You can't convict someone based on a statistical likelihood, you're saying. You have to have particularized evidence.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Thank you. I couldn't have said it better if I talked up here for 2 hours. So let me just cover a couple of other things. Can we talk about this private company issue, perhaps? So let me first note that in the Damon case out of the Western District, it's sort of an anecdote of the whole story, which is that the issue was not briefed by the parties. One of the members of the court figured it out. Now, the law in this Toomey case out of Ohio, that was an extreme case, right? The judge was actually getting more money based on the number of convictions. We're not asserting this case goes that far. And if we look at the stipulation of facts, I believe it is a true statement that the person from the company ATS has the first look. And then if that person thinks there's an offense, that goes to the police officer for the final look. And then the notice of violation. I mean, I think what works is that the police officer affixes an electronic signature after having viewed the video, and then it goes back to ATS. They send a notice, blah, 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 the money goes to the city. And then the city pays 31% to the company. I think if we really drill down on the point where ATS has a financial stake in it, they're going to get 31% of the money. So ATS, certainly we can say, wants as many tickets as possible. I mean, that's their economic interest. And
isn't the evidence here that police officers are the ones who review the pictures of stuff?
It's, as I just said, it's the second review. Okay. The first review is, and I don't know how it works, whether the ATS employees just watch constantly. I don't think that's the case, just based on my own experience, where when I have gotten a few of these, the light goes off as you go through. It's somehow this camera, I think, detects that the car starts moving before the light changes, if it's a right turn or whatever, on red. But the first look, the decision to send it to the policeman as opposed to not send it to the policeman is from an employee of the company. The company has a strong incentive to make money for shareholders. No, that's what companies do. I'm a capitalist. But I think there is an economic state that this court has to look at.
Excuse me. Would you mind explaining or telling me how you exhausted your remedies before you went into equitable action on this case?
Sure. So here's what happened. Sarah Tupper got her first ticket, and we had a trial, a bench trial. The first thing we did not raise anything at the municipal court. We didn't have a hearing at the municipal court. We immediately certified the case to the circuit court. So in the sense that we didn't exhaust in the municipal court, I would agree with that, but nothing happened in that court other than one filing. And there's a procedure where a person can take any municipal case to circuit court, just file a piece of paper, up she goes. And then we had a bench trial, and the judge found her guilty.
Did you raise the constitutional issue at the bench trial?
Yes, we filed a motion to dismiss and listed every single thing that we've talked about today, except that Damon argument about the private company, because nobody thought of that yet on our side. So then, about 2 days later, the Eastern District came out with the Unverfurth decision, which was very strong on this points issue. That was there. They drilled right down on it. Of course, Judge Omer, in this case, focused on the rebuttable presumption. But Judge Noble, in the city of St. Louis, issued about a page order that said, I'm acquitting her because of this points issue, that's the end of it. And then the city filed an appeal. And a few days, not days, but a couple, 3 weeks later, there were two more decisions that came down, very strongly anti-red light camera tickets. And there was a city councilor quoted as saying, we don't think any of this applies to us. These decisions don't mean anything in the city of St. Louis. And at that point, Sarah Tupper, who by then had gotten another ticket, and Sandy Thurman, who then had two, so each had a multiplicity, and we felt they should not have to defend them one by one because of this. You have to meet this multiplicity standard to bring an injunctive action. We thought we had it because we had two for each one, and then we filed the injunctive action. So all we did for Sarah Tupper was file the motion to dismiss, raising everything, had the trial, we won on the points, and then they appealed it. And I think Mr. Garvin is right. When the appeal, there was no reason to go on with the appeal once this case was briefed up and everything was moving. I have no criticism of the fact that he dismissed his appeal in that case because we covered everything in this one. We raised everything here as best we could.
If this court were not to find that this was a multiplicity of suits? Then would it be the wrong procedural vehicle?
I think that that the mootness issue is raised by that. Is two a multiplicity? Well, we have two clients, so there's a total of four. I think you're that would present a problem for my client. It would, very honestly.
What was the disposition of Ms. Thurman's charges?
Ms. Thurman's charges were dismissed, both of them, on that day when Judge Omer was poised. He said from the bench at about 3 o'clock the day before Thanksgiving a year ago, he said, I'm going to give this TRO. I'm going to stop this program right now based on these Court of Appeals decisions. And the attorneys for the city and ATS huddled together and said, well, Judge, we need half an hour. We're going to dismiss these cases and move this case out. And he said, well, okay. And so on our side, we huddled together and came up with the theory of evading review, capable of repetition, yet evading review, and then the case went on. But the cases were dismissed that day, and then we had spent endless time.
So these cases were dismissed?
That is correct. Now, not Tupper 1, because that correct. Was still on appeal, and the court
time.
Had no jurisdiction. Yeah.
Great, thank you. No further questions? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
I'll try to go over a few points very quickly. Mr. Schock talked about putting labels on that are inappropriate on various types of infractions. One label that I didn't get to mention the first time, excuse me, was that the city code has a provision that's in the record.
Get you some water.
Sorry about that.
It's okay.
City code has a provision in the record that says all municipal ordinance violations are civil. It's unlike every other ordinance in all the other cases. None had that specific directive. Excuse me. That's a legislative decision, and I think that it should be given great weight by this court. On the issue of points, we didn't get to talk about it the first time, but our stipulated Exhibit 26 in our case is a memorandum authored by the Office of State Courts Administrator in 2008, saying there's an ongoing question of whether these violations are reportable, meaning red light camera violations, to the Director of Revenue. OSCA's recommendation is that the ordinance violations enforced by red light cameras are not reportable to DOR.
Does OSCA have any authority to interpret state law or to supersede a statute?
OSCA and the Highway Patrol established the code. The code
I understand. Charges. Can they change the law? Can they create regulations?
No. From the city standpoint, the city is supposed to report violations using the charge code given to it by OSCA. So OSCA established a charge code for
which is the cart and the horse, though. Why is there any indication why they thought it was the 9 points? Is it because the points were never assessed, or are people notified that there won't be points? Does the ordinance say there won't be points?
I think you had multiple questions there, but I don't know how they reached that determination, but it was communicated to the city of St. Louis.
What does the ordinance say? It's silent.
The ordinance says nothing about it.
And what do the notices say?
The notices that the response received is that the state of Missouri does not assess points for red light camera violations, which is an accurate, true statement, because the only charge code for red light camera violations says no points.
But do we know, and none of the briefs address this, and maybe it's not in the record here, which came first? Where did the charge code come from? Out of the blue, or were there already existing ordinances that did not assess points, and that's where the charge code came from?
Everything I could tell, our ordinance was enacted in 2005. The first charge code that I could find was 2007, which is in the record, saying no points for red light camera violations.
So your ordinance could have said, how did your ordinance then say the state of Missouri does not assess points? Because at that point.
That was the form of the notice that responded to the state. We revised it multiple times over the
years. Did you assess points prior to the charge code being developed?
We were told that we don't assess points.
Did you report it first as a moving violation so that the state would assess points?
We did not report them on the instructions of the state administrators. And that actually was an issue in the Smith case, and that decision is in the record in this case. The trial judge there found you can't blame the city if the state told them not to report them. But I will say, in response to all these cases, we decided to start reporting them even though they didn't want them. So in the record now, it's stipulated, we are submitting electronic reports using the OSCA charge code for red light camera violations. And the stipulation also says that the Director of Revenue chooses not to upload them because that red light code is the one that's attached to it. And I'm not...
Did you say the Director of Revenue does not upload these
correct.
Reports?
Correct. That's a stipulation in our trial record, that the Director of Revenue receives our reports. We report the red light camera violations using the OSCA charge code, the only one for red light camera violations, and the Director of Revenue does not upload them.
Even though OSCA may not have authority to issue rules, do you have any authority that you can rely on what OSCA said?
I think under 302, we're supposed to report violations using the charge codes provided to us, and that's what we do. And as Mr. Lang said, if there's a problem with how we report them, I think that's an administrative problem, and that does not affect the validity of the ordinance itself, because the ordinance doesn't address any of that. That would be an administrative fix that we can make overnight. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you.